I look forward to the next few minutes of the morning show very much, as I am confronted by not one, not two, but three of my faculty colleagues from Carthage College for a conversation that I think is going to take us in some very interesting directions, and all around the ever-fascinating topic of language, of how we use language, of how we learn language, and in particular, how life can be so much enriched when we know more than one language. We explore the experience of multilingualism in the home with my three guests today. Matt Borden has joined us before. He is an assistant professor of Spanish at Carthage and has been a previous guest on the morning show for his successful run on the television program Wheel of Fortune. I'm glad we have the chance today, as fun as that was, of talking about weightier matters. Also joining us, another previous guest to the morning show, Wayne Thompson, who is associate professor of sociology at Carthage. And then finally, a colleague of mine and friend from the music department, Dmitry Shapovalov, who is assistant professor of music. And between these three gentlemen, we are talking about English and French and Spanish and Russian and perhaps other languages as well. And the delicious stew which results when more than one language is spoken in one's life and in one's home. So that is what we talk about for the next few minutes, and I suspect that 45 minutes will not be enough. Matt Borden and Wayne Thompson and Dmitry Shapovalov, we welcome all of you to the morning show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have all of you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm trying to remember whose idea this was.
Matt, you came up with the original.
Well, yeah, as a professor of Spanish, and my wife is also a professor of Spanish, we speak Spanish in the home. We happen to have one daughter who outnumbers us, 1-2, and she's she's 4.5 now, and since we're both Spanish professors, we only speak Spanish to her. She was born in Milwaukee in Wisconsin, so she is a native of the United States, but her first language is Spanish because we only speak Spanish in the home. The English that she has learned has come from television and from preschool and daycare and from my family, you know, other family members of mine who don't speak Spanish.
So you were thinking about your own experience in terms of what you and your wife have decided to do with your daughter, Sophia, and then at some point it must have occurred to you that a conversation could expand beyond your own experience to involve a couple of your colleagues here.
Sure, yeah, this is my field, really, you know, language acquisition. And in my own classes, I've seen many students who have had some other language in the home, and I ask them whenever that happens, you know, how they came to learn that language and whether, you know, all their brothers and sisters knew the same amount that they did. And it's just a topic, of course, of interest to me, you know, since I decided to, you know, take my own studies in Spanish and eventually become a professor. And my colleagues here, of course, know other languages as well. So I think we've got really three different cases. I mean, I learned Spanish starting at the university. I had one small exposure in middle school. I had like a middle school Spanish class. That's all I had until I started college.
Wow.
So I started late, although, you know, I recall actually at a very young age being interested in language itself, in English. I remember, I have one specific memory of at the age of 5 thinking, chair, what sort of word is chair? Why is a chair called a chair? I remember thinking that. And so I think I'm wired in a certain way for language. But I didn't, like I said, I didn't really start learning a second language till I was in college. But my two colleagues here have different cases than me. I know Wayne is fluent in French, but I'm honestly not sure what your background was. How is it that you came to learn French?
Yeah, it's not actually fluent. I speak maybe closer to what you might call Franglish. I did not speak other than English, other languages, a little bit of high school German and college Spanish, but what happened is it came to me through marriage. I married my spouse is from Haiti, grew up in Haiti, and when we moved to Kenosha, my mother-in-law moved with us, and she speaks pretty much exclusively French, and so I knew that I was going to pick up some French in the home, but I got a little nervous because my mother-in-law, if you can imagine this, my mother-in-law and my spouse, my wife Gladys, were sitting at the kitchen table and night after night, and they'd be going on in French, and I kind of got curious, and they said, oh, no, just the grocery list, the relatives, various things. So I took a course at Carthage from one of the, what we call target language experts, the international students that come for master's degrees at Carthage, and so I took a French class and sat through that and learned the verb to be and to have in French, and kind of worked from there, picked up a few nouns and what I could at home, and it turned out that indeed my spouse and my mother-in-law were talking about me, but I had to learn to speak enough French to know that. So, and it was all very nice, you know, but still, a guy wants to know what your mother-in-law is talking about.
It can be helpful. So that this is quite recent then, because you haven't been at Carthage all that long.
Well, I'm in my 11th year now, been here a while. It was in the first 4 or 5 years that I was here that I started to learn French, and then much more rapidly in recent years. We have a 9-year-old daughter who first 3 years was just with grand-mère at home, and so everything was in French for her, even Scooby-Doo videos, everything's in French. And then we adopted a little girl from Guatemala a couple of years ago, now it's almost 3 years, and she, for her first 9 months of life, was exposed only to Spanish and then to English and French. And so everybody in the home has a sort of different situation with language. Now, what's spoken at home, though, much of it is in French. And we have French satellite TV, Radio France Internationale. So my 9-year-old daughter is subfluent. That's how they classify her, subfluent in French. And my French is sort of Lake Wobegon / French. I grew up in northern Wisconsin on a farm. So I can speak up north there, hey, yeah. And so my French, I've learned French from a Caribbean family. And when Quebec folks hear my French, they say, what is that? Sounds a little bit like up north, guys, but it's in French. Sounds a little bit Caribbean. When people from France hear my French, in between some furrowing of their brows, they say it sounds a little Caribbean, actually.
Hmm. So there, as if French wasn't exotic enough, it can have these local flavors to it that makes it even more interesting.
Though I claim to speak French sans accent, but that gets a lot of laughs from French speakers.
I suspect. Finally, Dmitry Shapovalov, who you were just telling us before we went on the air, actually came to English, a language you speak beautifully, really actually quite late, and you were indicating, in a sense, almost in a nick of time. Tell us where you grew up, and then at what point English became your new language.
Well, certainly learning English didn't seem like it happened in the nick of time for me. I got exposed to English at the age of 17 when my family emigrated from the Soviet Union. We were political refugees who experienced some hardship in my home country, and we moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota, where a cousin of my mom's sponsored us. And when we came to settle in a suburb of Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, I was 17 years old, and I found myself thrown into a linguistic environment that was entirely foreign to me. I hardly knew any words in English at that point, and I just remember my very first experience with trying to communicate to an American person when maybe several days after we arrived, I sort of finally got up enough courage to roam around the neighborhood and stumbled upon a garage sale, the lady that was there was among the items that were offered was a skateboard, and it took me a good 5 or 6 or 7 minutes to explain to her that I would like a skateboard. It was an awakening that I suddenly realized, wow, this is going to be a long road coming to know English. And as a musician, sound and meaning these topics play a prominent role in my life in any case, and I got fascinated with the role of language in shaping one's cultural identity, one's values and beliefs. And so this topic is very dear and very pertinent to my personal experience. So I'm looking forward to sharing some of my experiences with my colleagues and with you.
The phrase I used about a nick of time was in reference to something that I think you said, which is the fact that for most people, although Matt Borden sort of proves it wrong in a sense, as do you, I suppose, but that generally speaking, we have a great affinity for picking up language a little earlier in life, and that when you start to get to the age of 17, for many people, they have maybe already experienced kind of a drop-off in that affinity for language. Is that what you were saying before?
Yeah, and when I was... When my family was living in the neighborhood of St. Louis Park, which actually boasts a pretty prominent Russian community there. There is a few blocks that seem to be populated by Russian immigrants, at least the majority of the people who live there. So when I moved into that area, I got exposed to all kinds of linguistic backgrounds and Russians and their children learning English and children trying to retain Russian in many shapes and forms. So this was certainly a string of experiences that was very interesting for me to observe. I remember being neighbors with a family that arrived in St. Louis Park just like us, political refugees. Their son was 4 years old at the time when he arrived, and I got so envious of his ability to seemingly instantaneously pick up a language that to me was so hard to come to grips with. So this perception of time and language acquisition that is so drastically different when it comes to age is something that I relate to quite intensely.
Your description reminds me of something a Carthage student related to me, and Wayne, I will want to ask you about this as well. He spent a summer working in Costa Rica. I'm trying to remember if it was with the Peace Corps, because it was a fairly short little stint there, really just the summer. But I remember Nick saying, among other things, that one of the hardest things was the fact that even though he knew Spanish to some extent, I mean, he'd taken a fair amount of Spanish, but he did not know Spanish well enough at all to carry on a truly meaningful conversation with somebody. I mean, he could really translate. He could have bought a skateboard or really communicated about just about any of the sort of nuts and bolts affairs of daily life. But Nick is, as you, Dimitri, a cerebral person who enjoys thinking profound thoughts and sharing them with others and, you know, having deep conversations. And that was utterly impossible for him in Costa Rica because of the matter of language. And until he shared that with me, I'd never stopped to think about how that is one facet of language that most of us probably don't even stop to think about.
And well, I think that that has to do with what Dimitri said about his neighbor, was a 4-year-old or 5-year-old neighbor who seemed to, I don't know if you said flip the switch or something, that he could suddenly just learn English if he wanted to. And there is, it's a demonstrated fact that children are able to pick up languages much quicker and more authentically than adults. And there is a time when language learning, becomes extremely difficult and it advances with age. But in Dimitri's case, I mean, he speaks perfect English. There's no question about it. He has an accent in English, but his English is perfect. He could express anything he wants to in English, and he can understand anything that is expressed in English.
But not when he was 18.
Well, not at that
Certainly
time.
Not
at that time.
And the fact that, I mean, at some point you want to get to that point in a language where you can express sort of the deepest feelings. I mean, Wayne, at some point you wanted to be able to say more than to your mother-in-law than just, do you want gravy on your mashed potatoes? I mean, you wanted to.
And that involves idioms, which are particular not only within French, in my case, but also particular to Caribbean, a particular part of the Caribbean, and even the objects of everyday life are variable. So it's not only a matter of picking up on the idioms, but the emotional nuances, the tones of voice, and also in French they have the formal, the formal, and the more familiar forms. Now, because I learned at home, I get by at home okay because I use the familiar form, which I know Spanish is similar. They have that. But when I meet some of the folks at Carthage and in the community who are French speakers, and I address them in the familiar, at first they're a little taken back, but I always apologize that I can speak French pretty well if they'll allow me to use the familiar. So that's one issue. Hmm. On the issue of learning a little bit later in life, I was in my 40s when I started to learn French, but it was on a need-to-know basis. I would hear my wife or my belle-mère, my mother-in-law, trying to discipline our 9-year-old daughter. Daughter is now 9, and I didn't really know what they were saying, but eventually you can pick up on it. So I understand some of the things that you would say to a child, and I understand the idioms, the tones of voice, and so on. So, for instance, sort de là in French means get out of there. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you would say to a child over and over. So I can be seem a little bit rude or perhaps imprudent when I am speaking in the familiar to people who don't know me, but it's because I learned it in the context of the family. My French isn't that good, but keep in mind I use it every day, every day, every day. And so when I come home to my home, there's certain things that I learn to say, and I feel very comfortable expressing myself in that way. Now, if I get to a setting, you know, in the community or at Carthage, and I use that kind of familiar language, you know, you don't want to tell a colleague, sort or lock, get out of there, you know. But it's it seems so natural, but it was a real learning process. And to learn a language in your 40s, for me, it was my mid and even into my late 40s. I'm in my early 50s now, kind of give away my age. That was quite a challenge, but I needed to do it. When I went to Guatemala to adopt my little Noelle, our little cutie pie there, who's going to be 4 in May, I would be carrying her around, and there's a lot of security in downtown Guatemala City, a lot of guns and people sticking guns in your face, and it was amazing how fast my college Spanish came back to me. Los documentos. Mm, you know, it's like I'm just reaching in there for that.
Out of necessity.
And so a need-to-know basis.
Sure. Bet. And so that would have been your situation, of course, too. I mean, you obviously, as you said, thrown into this situation where without knowing a word of English, and you had to begin learning it yesterday.
Exactly. And what was particularly amazing to me was how the learning of those intangibles of language happen in a person of my age then. I'll give an example. Talking about learning not just meaning of words or sentences, but all the cultural baggage that goes into truly idiomatic way of speaking, thinking a particular language. I remember I had to spend 1 year in a high school, the St. Louis Park High School, and a few weeks into the semester, at a class, American history class, in fact, the teacher pointed to me and asked me a question which I didn't understand, which was an experience that was very common for me at that time. And the only answer that I could muster at the time was a very bravura-filled, "but of course," which is a phrase that I had just learned in an ESL class. And when I said those words, the entire class thundered in this outburst of laughter. And later on, I learned that the question that the teacher asked was, "Do you think, Dimitri, that Russian students are superior to English students, to American students?" So what I took away from that experience is not so much the meaning of the question and what he was asking me, but the context in which this sort of petulant reply, "but of course," when placed in a particular context of a question, can generate this sort of response, which has very little to do with the meaning of those, with the precise meaning of those words, and everything to do with the context in which those words are understood and reacted to by a native audience.
And who's saying them, and to whom you're saying it.
Yes, and particularly the response that a certain utterance can cause, which to me has to do with the meaning of language as such. When I think about language, I like to think of it as a medium that goes well beyond simply communicating information.
Mm.
To me, language is a way of seeing the world outside me. It's a way of experiencing reality and communicating, connecting, rather, those experiences. So the idiomatic way in which we in which English speakers, Americans, use English, it differs from the way British people use English, and it differs in the way in which they connect the different idioms. What does it mean exactly to pick up a language? Why do we say the phrase pick up? Does it have something to do with the physical act of picking up? I mean, it's things like that. Infusion of sports metaphors, for example, into American English, to me, it's very telling. It's nowhere near the same experiences that I observed in Russian. The Russians don't relate to sports this way.
And it's a nation that knows a lot about athletic greatness, but somehow it must look at it differently, or in some way or another,
somehow
your language does not reflect the same sort of fascination or preoccupation somehow.
Exactly.
And you have to learn that from others. I came at a certain point where I wanted to learn how to speak kind of the language of the street a little bit, and be able to, say, talk a little bit in more amorous ways with my spouse. And not realizing we're in public radio here, but my spouse, Gladys, was not going to teach me. She said, no, we're not going there. So I had to go to the target language experts who spoke French, a couple of African guys, a guy named Sylvestre in particular, is from Senegal. And he said, okay, but, you know, your wife's going to find out, and then she'll blame me. But indeed, he did teach me some of the language of the street, and I did go home, and I got pinched for it. And, you know, but these things you have to learn from other people because of the context and the nuances you would have to learn. But in that case, unfortunately for Sylvestre, my wife figured out who had taught me, and he got in trouble.
So in other words, these are the kind of things you don't learn in a textbook.
Even a book of idioms, because of the interweaving of it.
Sure, I suppose, and some unique flavors.
Textbook learning is useful, but there's no way you will become fluent by reading a book. You have to go live somewhere, and this is why I tell my students all the time, you know, and they're in language classes, they're learning the language. This is a great start, I tell them. You have to go somewhere. You have to go where they speak the language, and you speak it all day, every day, and stay there as long as you can. And if you just add up the hours, a student taking a college class, let's say, you know, and this would be for your listeners, you know, maybe they have students who are going to go off to college or are in college now. They take probably a one-hour class three times a week, so that's 3 hours a week for 15 weeks. They get about 45 contact hours, and what I'm calling a contact hour is that they're either speaking or hearing, you know, the language that they're learning. 45 contact hours. Now, they'll have some homework time and stuff, so if you want, we can bump it up to 60, let's say. But reading a book, and it's not really a contact hour. It's someone is speaking to you, and you have to react, and you have to say something. You have to produce the language, or you have to hear it and, you know, react to it. So let's say 60 contact hours in one semester. Well, if you go to Peru or Mexico or France or wherever, another country, you're going to have contact hours every hour that you're not asleep, because everything you do will be in that language. So if you sleep 8 hours, the rest of the time is contact hours, so you have 16 a day. Well, after 4 days, you've got 64 hours. So just based on contact hours, 4 days abroad is like a semester. Now, you learn more during a semester than you would in 4 days, but for contact hours, it is so quickly a complete landslide for being abroad that it's really the only way. It's a must to learn a language. You have to go abroad. Dimitri's case, he came here to the U.S. So, I mean, you know, it was trial by fire.
Yeah, he went abroad in a way that we don't often think.
But. Emigrated. And so, you know, his exposure to English is, you know, off the charts. I mean, he's been living here since that time.
Hmm.
But for someone who, and this is one of the things I really wanted to talk about today, someone who wants their children to learn another language, obviously, if you're in the United States, you're not in a country where, you know, you're going to get those contact hours. So the question is, how do you get your children to learn another language?
Hmm.
You have to do it through schooling, of course. But, Wayne, I think you said that you sent your children to, well, you've got tutors, you have French in the home.
But classes as well.
But you've also done some classes outside.
Yeah, and it's taken some effort. There's a small company, won an award for as a startup company in Chicago a few years ago, a company called Language Stars. And they have several locations in the north suburbs, which are close enough to Kenosha, but still, that's an hour drive. So we would go to Highland Park and Skokie and various places, Wilmette, and take classes from the time Leah was three. We're taking a different route with the little girl we got from Guatemala, and that is having tutors. So we've hired one of the target language experts from Carthage, Mathilde Launay, comes to our house on Monday nights, does half an hour or 40 minutes with the older girl, where that's all conversational and it's fine, they do great. But for the little girl, she gets maybe 20 minutes to 30 minutes. And what we're finding is that she is able to comprehend French, she understands, but she will not speak back in French. So there is a barrier there, and this is going to take some work. So we've tried everything, even Scooby-Doo. I mentioned Scooby-Doo in French. You know, Scooby-Doo in English is kind of a doofus, basically.
Mm-hmm.
In French, he's also a doofus, but it actually reinforces the language concepts. And it turns out SpongeBob is Bob Éponge in French, you know. And he's also quite a doofus in French, believe me.
So personality survives the language change.
But the voices are different. So the first time I heard The Wizard of Oz in French, it was kind of off-putting. I wasn't used to those voices being used, but it was another tool to learn. And now when I hear Judy Garland and you know, hear in English in The Wizard of Oz, it doesn't sound right to me. So anything you can use, video, French television, relatives calling on the phone from Haiti or from Quebec, all of this fits together. It's an intermediate ground. It's not the same as being immersed in another culture because you're not exposed to all the context. But I am exposed to the family context. My children are exposed to the family context, and it is, and the media and so on. So it's a kind of an intermediate ground, a little bit short of what you're describing, going to another culture.
But it's about like the next best thing. I mean, as much as you could approximate that without that final step, in a sense.
Yes, we also send our oldest daughter goes to Concordia Language Villages in the summer, which is a very well-known program. Chelsea Clinton went there. And they those are just wonderful. It's a kind of a long bus ride up there, and then I drive up to pick up Leia at the end of her time.
And how long is that?
Well, she did 1 week the first year when she was only eight, and 2 weeks last year, and she can't wait to go back. They it's immersion, so they're speaking only in the target language, and they have the teachers are from, you know, from France and from different French-speaking countries in Africa and so on.
Sure, they're native speakers. So.
Or what they now call heritage speakers.
Heritage speakers.
They grew up with it. And so that helps, too. And the language camp idea is a very, very good one. But, again, it's based on an immersion experience. So for us, it's bits and pieces, and we hope we get there. With the little girl that we adopted, having been exposed to Spanish the first 9 months, and then, you know, it's been more difficult. But when I noticed when she goes to daycare, because she's Hispanic looking, the teachers at her preschool in Kenosha speak in Spanish to her. So when we start counting in French, un, deux, trois, she starts up with the uno, dos, tres, cuatro, because she's learning that at school. So, and I think the more languages, the better. So if our kids can learn to speak Spanish, this is a tremendous advantage. And so Spanish, French, more is better, and I think, you know, in many ways the U.S. we think of as a melting pot, as kind of having a unitary culture, but the idea of having multiple languages, I think, is a very enriching thing. And the idea of America being a unitary culture, I would make an exception with languages. I think that that's something that's very, very fruitful, and more is better, not less.
I interviewed an author who wrote a fascinating book about Chinese restaurants, about, first of all, how pervasive they are in our culture, how they're not all that authentically Chinese, in fact, and, you know, this and that. One of the things she said at the very end of her fascinating book is she likes to think of America not as a melting pot, but as a stir fry, in that you have these different elements that go into a stir fry, and it still looks like broccoli, and it still tastes like broccoli, and all the different
ingredients. Or a patch quilt is another metaphor.
Sure, but I mean, but the idea that these different elements retain something of what they were to begin with, and yet there's this wonderful sense of mixing, but not to the point where it all becomes kind of a homogenous blend where you don't find anything of the individual cultures that were the ingredients, which is kind of what you're describing. Matt Borden, I know that you are anxious to tell us about an interesting experience that you had with your daughter, Sophia, which really underscores the importance of being actually within another culture when it comes to language and taking it on.
Yeah, that's true. And my case is somewhat like Wayne's in that, you know, we speak the... In our house, we only speak Spanish, as I think I said before, the target language that we want Sophia to learn. Generally speaking, your child will learn the language of the community by themselves. In other words, if you live in France, you don't have to teach your children French. They're going to get it eventually, you know, because they live there. Dimitri lives in the United States. He learned English, and he had no preparation before he came, and, you know, we all know how well he speaks. So children, it's true, and children will learn the language of the community. So there's nothing you need to do. So we didn't worry about teaching Sophia English, and she knows English now too. And we never speak to her in English. But she has to know it to speak to other kids and so on and so forth, and so she can learn it by herself. So what we concentrated on, and this is what it's very hard to do, and, of course, you need to have the skills. I mean, Wayne, you know, uses his French, and his wife is a native French speaker. You know, both parents, the best way is that both parents would use the language at home and only use that language. But in our case, we wanted Sophia to know Spanish. We go to Spain a lot, maybe twice a year, and we tend to stay a long time. In our profession, teachers, my wife is also a teacher, as I said, so we have the summers free if we choose. We don't have to teach, so we can go to Spain, and we typically do, and there's things for us to do, you know, academically there. But, you know, we also see the in-laws, my wife's parents and family and everything. So Sophia has, you know, from a very young age, I mean, she's only 4 and a half now, but she's probably been to Spain 5 times. I'm not even sure. Maybe more. I'm not sure. And I've been 25 or 30, and I lived there for 3 years. So, and my wife is from Madrid. So we have a very authentic sort of Spanish household, but it's Spanish-American, too. And what I did was, when Sophia was 2, and I should mention also that bilingual children, in other words, children that are given a language that is not the language of the community where they're living, children that are learning a language at home that is not the language of the community tend to speak later. They don't start speaking as quickly as monolingual children because they're getting two languages from one way or another. You know,
so in
one
in
the home, one from TV. Or,
so you're saying it slows them down in a sense?
Well, technically, they would start producing speech later.
Right.
So if that means slowing them down, yeah. But what they're doing is they're wiring their brain for 2 syntaxes and 2 cultural registers and 2, you know, sets of, you know, vocabulary.
And, of course, ultimately you end up with something far deeper.
Right,
so it's not ultimately a negative thing at all.
Right, right. I'm certain Sophia knows many more words than just about all of her peers, but not in English. I mean, she knows... you know, she knows more Spanish than English. She has a slight accent in English sometimes, and it's getting, you know, less and less all the time. Mm-hmm. But her syntax right now is correct in both languages, but her syntax used to be shifting towards Spanish. So she would say something like, look at that house red, rather than look at that red house. When she was speaking in English, she would say, look at that house red, because in Spanish that would be the word order.
Mm.
And she's cleared up most of those things. So her English is taking care of itself. We have no worries. But when she was 2, I made a list. We were living in Milwaukee, and I made a list just after her second birthday in the month of May of all the words that she produced by herself that came out of her without prompting. You know, she would look at something and say a word or something like that. And those of us in the studio here, we have these lists in front of us, but there were about 20 nouns in English, 21 other sort of assorted words, 8 verbs, and just four sentences or phrases that she could produce in English. And that was in May. In Spanish in May, she knew more Spanish than English. As far as vocabulary goes, she knew less phrases. She only knew one phrase in Spanish, which was ¿qué es?, which means what is that? That was the only phrase she had in Spanish, and only 3 verbs in Spanish, but she had 8 in English. The reason she knew more English was because she was going to daycare. She would go to daycare all day. And, you know, at home, she knew more words with us, but at the daycare, there were certain words that she would use in English, you know, draw or jump or sit, wait, things that they said at the daycare that we'd never say because we never spoke English. But, you know, let's say it was about 50-50 as far as, you know, the words that she knew in both English and Spanish. Although, again, we only use Spanish at home. So then I wrote all those words down. And then in August, after we had spent the entire summer in Spain, this is August of 2006, I did it again. And I just, you know, during the month of August, wrote down things that she would say of her own accord.
So you kind of keeping a log.
I did it very systematically and scientifically and just wrote down every time I heard her say something. And if it was a different word, then I would write that down. So her English decreased after 3 months in Spain. And of course, she didn't get any English in Spain. She got 0. But she still retained it. It didn't go away completely. So this is a 2-year-old.
And it looks just at a glance like roughly almost half of the English went away.
Her numbers dropped about in half. So she said 20 different words, 20 different nouns in May, and then only 11 by the time August came. She had 8 verbs in May and then only 4 in August. But the most interesting thing about this is then looking at the Spanish in August. And it's, you know, several pages worth of words that came out. Initially, she had 44 nouns in May and 95 in August, 3 verbs in May and 41 in August, 19 assorted words in May in Spanish, and then 66 in August. She had 1 phrase in May, and in August, 47 separate phrases in Spanish. So that's what happens to a 2-year-old. I mean, there's a certain point where they take off. So this was really her takeoff point. But it was, you know, every day, all day, with the in-laws, speaking Spanish. When she went to the park, everyone spoke Spanish, and it was all Spanish all the time, every day. And, of course, if we didn't bring her back to the U.S., you know, her English would have disappeared completely.
Right. I'm just curious, how much, she's 4?
She's 4 and a half now, yeah.
How much do you talk with her about this? I mean, does she ask about why do we speak Spanish at home and why do I speak English other places? I mean, is this itself a topic of conversation?
Yeah, not frequently, but it is. And she recognizes that she knows there are other languages. And at this point, she knows that French is the language and Chinese is the language, and she's learned a couple phrases, and, you know, she knows how to say ni hao, which is hello in Chinese, and xie xie, which is thank you. I don't think she knows any French yet, but, you know, occasional things that might show up in a cartoon or something like that. But she's aware of the idea of other languages, and since we go to Spain so frequently, I mean, frequently compared to, I think, the general public, you know, she knows, and we've told her, okay, well, you know, in Spain they speak Spanish, and in other countries they speak another language. And, of course, this is our field, both my wife and I. So it is a conversation that we've had, you know, not decidedly. Now today we're going to tell her about language. But it just comes up all the time.
Sure.
We get some resistance from our daughters. The 9-year-old speaks French much better. She will respond to me in English.
That is the very interesting thing, and that is actually common. That's a common thing, and I'm waiting for this to happen with Sophia. And again, for your listeners, if you want your child, I mean, you have to be very disciplined about it. If you speak English to them, it's like showing weakness in front of a lion or something like that. They will then use English, and they're like, oh, you know what? Dad knows English. Now, why am I bothering with this other language?
Well, and they sense that I'm a native English speaker.
Yeah.
And so even though I will speak to them in French, they will respond in English. And so that is takes some intentionality, and I'm always saying, you know, parle français, not because I don't like English. I like it very, very much, you know, and especially Lake Wobegon English, but but it's intentionality, and working. We have to work very, very hard at it, and we do get some results. The immersion experiences do help. Having a person in our home, my belle-mère, my mother-in-law, who speaks only French, is a tremendous advantage, because even the little girl has to learn to speak to her grandmother in French, and that's a necessity. So that does help, but it's a struggle. And in public, people wonder. I'll speak in French to them, and the kids respond in English, and they look and they're wondering what's going on between us. But there is that struggle indeed, and you have to be pretty disciplined and stick with it. When the phone answers, you have to be ready for anything, because my wife's relatives are in Montreal. They're also in Haiti, and somebody calls from Haiti and says, another cousin got kidnapped. Get down to Western Union, send the money. Haiti's a difficult situation right now.
Yeah.
And they're speaking in rather hurried tones and so on. I need to understand, and if I don't, I put my 9-year-old on the phone, and she picks it up in a hurry. When people are agitated and nervous and speaking rapidly, and it's sort of broken Creole and French, coming from Haiti, I don't always pick up everything, and my Creole is very marginal.
Wow, and in those situations where you desperately want to understand what's being said.
I heard the Western Union part. I know that's another cousin got kidnapped. Mm.
Well, Wayne, let me ask you, do you think your 9-year-old knows more French than you?
Yes, she does. She is better with verbs, certainly, and verbs sort of tell the tale. I can learn a lot of nouns, and it won't do you much good if you can't get yourself into verbs and the tenses that they imply.
If those nouns can't do something or have something happen to them.
Well, and tenses especially, and she's much better than I.
And the 9-year-old, of course, knows more than it's three. Noelle, did you say?
Noelle is going to be 4 in May. Yeah.
Okay, so she knows more than Noelle.
Yes, there are things I'll say to Noelle that she won't always understand, but most of it she does understand. And it's not so much that I speak to her in French. She's not learning so much from that. But she learns when her mother speaks in French and when grand-mère speaks in French. And that's where the real learning is coming.
Well, what happens, another thing that happens for your listeners, if they've got more than one child, which is probably the case, that the older children tend to be better language speakers of the second language than the younger children. And usually this is because the older children, use English, if we're in the United States, they use the language of the community to speak to the younger children. In other words, your youngest is getting English from your oldest.
Yes.
And your oldest didn't get that because she didn't have an older
child. It was all in French.
So the proportion is different.
That's right. They're getting more English than the oldest child is getting. Got less English than
because
the
of the siblings.
Yeah, because of the existence of the siblings.
Dimitri wants to tell us, I know, about an interesting situation with relatives of his that live in France,
This
is, in some respects, a still more complicated situation.
It is quite complicated, and at this point, it is strange to me that I don't actually have any immediate relatives in Russia at all. All of my family is either in the United States or in Europe, as is the case with my half-sister Tanya, who lives in France, and this is where it gets complicated. Her husband is German, and obviously she herself is Russian. She has native knowledge of Russian. Their children are therefore immersed in an environment that has three different languages going at any given point in time. And it is fascinating to me, whenever I come visit, it is fascinating for me to observe how they tend to pick a person and assign a linguistic identity to him or her and communicate in language of their choosing. For example, amongst themselves, their children, Denis is 11, and Nina, his younger sister, is 9. Amongst themselves, they speak exclusively French, as is expected.
That's the language of their community.
That's their language of their community. That's right. Now, Tanya, my sister, their mother, Tanya has made a conscious effort. So her case is illustrative of a very conscious effort made by a parent to retain her own native language and teach it to Nina and Denis. I've observed her repeatedly telling them, speak Russian to me, speak Russian to me. And as a result, even though they're 9 and 11, their knowledge of Russian is well beyond satisfactory. In fact, both my parents and I have been extremely pleased to hear Russian idioms being used. Sure, they sometimes confuse sentence order, and their way of declining verbs is sometimes questionable. But regardless, this is an example of a family where the children have. I don't think they've ever actually visited Russia. In any case, for any extended periods, but they do have a very good knowledge of Russian in an environment that has nothing to do with that language. Mm. So it is indeed possible.
But when they come and visit here, you see very different dynamics at play.
The environment seems to influence their desire to speak different languages in a great way. When their entire family comes over from France to my parents' house in Minnesota, where Russian is spoken almost exclusively, I see them wanting to speak Russian much more than when we come visit them in France. And this is fascinating to me because they prefer French. This is the language that they're most comfortable with. But whenever they come visit, something changes, and they address my mom. They address me, and my dad too, in Russian with a greater ease. And I'm not sure how much of it is a subconscious sort of way of processing that information that they're guests in a different linguistic community.
And thinking about it maybe harder. Is that what you're saying, or treating it with greater care because of that?
Yeah, to me it really does have, it seems to have a lot with not so much the skill with which they handle Russian. It's not like their vocabulary changes. Rather, what changes is the desire to use Russian, which is very telling.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, as I've suspected, time ran away from this fascinating conversation. I hope what we've managed to do, among other things, is get people thinking about what an enriching experience this might be for them individually and for them in their homes and so on. And I'm suspecting, Professor Borden, that someone who had great interest in this and maybe wanting to carry on the conversation further would be welcome to contact you at Carthage.
Oh, of course, sure. If anyone has questions or, you know, looking for strategies. The main thing is it's like a number of things. It takes a lot of work. You know, you can't lose weight. You can't pick up a sport. You can't be a great whatever, unless you really work at it. And to get kids to learn a language, it's going to be English, unless you give them, you know, as many opportunities as you can in another language.
Hmm. Well, we hope that people will give this good thought. In the meantime, I think we've had a fascinating conversation with Matt Borden and Wayne Thompson and Dmitry Shapovalov, three faculty members at Carthage College. I thank you all for being a part of this conversation today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.